Good morning and welcome to a special Meet the Candidates edition of Midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten, and today we've taken the show on the road to the Metropolitan Ballroom in Golden Valley, where the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is hosting the first debate of the general election campaign between the major candidates for the U.S. Senate here in Minnesota. Now, last week, Minnesota primary election voters narrowed the field of would-be senators. Today, the winners of last week's primary, Republican Senator Rod Grams, former DFL State Auditor Mark Dayton, and software developer and independence candidate James Gibson, have joined us here at the Metropolitan to debate the issues and to try to win your vote. Now, remember the old saying, what's good for General Motors is good for America? I'm not sure that was ever necessarily true, but it is true that the issues topping the list of concerns for these business people in Minnesota also top the list of concerns for all Minnesotans: rising cost of health care, taxes, education, trade, and globalization. And those are some of the issues that the candidates will be discussing today. We should note that the Minnesota Chamber is no newcomer to politics. Chamber members, by their own count, have been involved in this process since 1909. More specifically, they've been sponsoring these statewide candidate debates since 1994, and we'd like to thank the Chamber for inviting us to moderate this year's edition. I'd like to have a good give and take and keep this all fairly informal. So, candidates, I'll try to rotate the questions around between you, but do feel free to jump in whenever you'd like. If you would, please just let me know when you'd like to speak so I can let the listeners on the radio know who's actually talking. Try to keep your comments relatively short so we can hear from all three of you on as many issues as possible. And those of you here in the audience, get your questions ready. We'll open it up for your questions in just a couple of minutes. But first of all, if you'd allow me, I'd like to start with a question of my own. There are already apparently about 44 million people in this country who don't have health care coverage, and the cost of coverage for those who do have it is apparently starting to increase sharply again, 20% to 30% this year. Mark Dayton, you would require employers to provide health care coverage. Your opponents say your plan would bankrupt many small businesses in the process. How do you plead?
Well, Gary, I appreciate you starting me off with the easy one. I plead responsible for wanting to provide health coverage for every American, and especially every working American and his or her family. I would just say we're the only industrialized nation in the world that does not provide health coverage for all of its citizens. We spend the highest percent of our gross domestic product, 14% annually, on health care. We spend more per person on health care, almost $4,300, than any other country. Yet, as you said, Gary, 44 million Americans have no health insurance. That's an increase of almost 10 million during the last decade, during this period of economic expansion. And 25 3/4 of those 44 million are in families where at least one person works full time. 25 million Americans in the workplace have no health insurance. That's almost 18% of the workforce. And I believe that that's wrong. And I believe that this country can design, if we have the collective will, a system that is unique to America, that is, takes advantage of the best health care resources in the world, that takes advantage of our ingenuity, our corporate productivity, and also extends the kind of coverage for every working American that Senator Wellstone, Senator Grams, and every other member of Congress enjoys. And I do so through employer mandates because I believe in the old-fashioned work ethic. I believe that work should pay and it should pay off. And I think there's something fundamentally wrong with our priorities in this country when people who are on welfare or are in prison have complete health coverage, but people who work don't. And there are certain basic options to deal with that. There's the status quo, allowing conditions in the work health care to continue to deteriorate for those who don't have it, and for increasing numbers of Minnesotans who are believe they're covered but are getting denied the care that they are entitled to. We can have a national system, which I don't favor. I don't think that federal government is a particularly good service delivery manager. Or we can have a system that shares that responsibility primarily in the private sector with businesses, employees, and the government coming in with purchasing pools to allow small businesses, the self-employed, farmers to purchase health insurance at the kind of competitive rates that larger employers enjoy, tax credits that businesses would, particularly small businesses, would receive, especially in the initial years, that would be government funded, and that would then incorporate the balance into a $9 trillion GDP, which I believe this country can afford and cannot afford not to provide.
Senator Grahams, how would you approach the problem?
Well, I'm kind of interested in how Mark lays this all out as being something that would be provided in the private sector. But those are basically words he hides behind, because what he has outlined basically is another government takeover, and this would be a takeover of the health care system. It's nothing more than Hillary Care reinvented for the year 2000, not 1993. Now, Mark lays out all these mandates for employers. Who's going to carry out these mandates? Who's going to impose the certain kind of coverage and to make sure that it's carried? It would be the government that would do that for you. When he talks about the bureaucrats that would manage it, he admits that the government is not a good manager, but yet his plan would put the government in control of this type of health care system. Then he talks about mandated coverage. Who and what kind of coverage would be? Would it be prescription drugs? Would it be hip replacements? Would you be qualified for any kind of heart surgery? And then he talks about, you know, national health care, and that would produce nothing but long lines and waiting lists. But then again, he dives behind and says, well, we'd have the private sector do this. That wouldn't happen under Mark Dayton's plan. And he talks about having a plan as good as Senator Paul Wellstone and I have, and that is the Federal Employee Health Benefit Package, the FEHBP, which all it is private sector insurance that we have a choice to buy. So he's trying to make it sound like Congress has something special. We don't. In fact, I buy a plan just off the shelf that anybody here or anybody listening in the audience would have as well. And this is exactly the kind of plan that I have supported in the Republican plan, the Patients' Bill of Rights Plus, and that is to give people those type of options. I also thank Mark for agreeing with me for full deductibility of health care coverage. I have introduced that bill. I strongly support it. I have in past Congresses and this Congress. Also, I say we need to have medical savings accounts to allow people the opportunity to buy that kind of coverage that they like. And, in fact, we had a pilot program that allowed so many policies, about 40,000. It was limited to try and make it fail, but about a third of the people who bought MSAs never had insurance before. So to make insurance affordable is another big priority, to get rid of some of the red tape that the government imposes, and then also to make sure that we don't have the government controlling everything. So I think there's a lot of things we can do in the private sector. The Patients' Bill of Rights Plus plan that I support in Congress would accomplish most of these objectives. We need to try find ways to get everybody health care coverage. And the government should come in as a last resort to help those that can, not as a first resort to cover everybody under a national health care plan.
James Gibson, how would you address this problem?
Well, the issue of health care, you know, Mark, the problem I have with your position, it isn't that it's not a noble position to try to ensure the 44 million. I think we need to strive for that. But the problem is what your method is the equivalent of saying, of arbitrarily, by fiat, if you will, simply saying we should all make, say, an extra $3 an hour so we can afford health care. There's no doubt how much an individual makes is related to whether they're able to afford health care. But where I take exception is this arbitrary nature about you simply can't direct higher wages by fiat without creating a great deal of unemployment. The conditions we have in this economy long term will help to solve this problem. If we can maintain the same kind of policies, the same kind of economic growth we've had the last 4 years, if we can maintain that for the next 10 years, for example, we're going to make tremendous strides in solving these problems. The question is, then, what do we do in the short term? And frankly, I see something we need to reevaluate in the way of health care. The link between employment and health care, to me, seems to be a bit outdated, perhaps no longer productive. It interferes with the ability of employees to move from job to job. You know, the capitalism thrives on a fluidity of reallocation of resources, and what the system we have today inhibits that. I'd like to see long-term us move to a system where perhaps we all had our own medical savings accounts, as Rod Graham suggested, but where you contract directly with insurance companies for your insurance, and where the employer contributes to the medical savings account. That would allow individuals then to exercise some. There's a reason for individuals to economize and to search for the best health care value.
Anyone, Mark Dayton?
I respond. Senator, I'm aware of the plan that you were citing for yourself and members of Congress, and I was not trying to imply that you had any, or any member of Congress has any special advantage over other federal employees. My point was that, and you're correct, that you have the ability to buy that, as I have the ability, and those of us who are at income levels that can afford health care can afford the best quality health care in the world. Most working Minnesotans don't receive nearly that level of income. Most of the uninsured are working Minnesotans and working Americans who are at 200% of the incomes at 200% of the poverty level or less. And I don't think you can reasonably say that my solution or a variant of it is unconscionably expensive, as both of you say, for our society, but then pretend that your solution somehow with, you know, you talk about hiding behind words, savings accounts and deductions and the like. I mean, that's the magic wand solution. Let's admit that this is a major issue, and it's either going to be left untouched, as you both recommend, or we're going to address it, as I propose, not through national health insurance, and Senator, you should know better than to try to portray it. I want to expand the 82%, the way the 82% of working Americans get their health care, which is in the workplace, employer and employee. I want the government, yes, to be, as a mandate, the last resort. But I'm for some resort rather than no resort, which leaves increasing numbers of Americans without any coverage, which all the rest of us pay for indirectly. $10 billion a year, it's estimated that the emergency rooms pay for the uninsured. That comes back to us in either higher premiums or higher taxes. So we can either do it more efficiently, we can use the business community's ingenuity to bring down the costs. I agree with you, Senator, that these costs are rising unconscionably for employers and for employees. The average employee pays now 27% of the cost of copay for less access, less choice than before. And I certainly agree there's plenty of there are efficiencies that can be gained in the public sector, but let's not overlook the fact that we have significant cost savings that could be gained in the private sector, pharmaceutical industry, these for-profits that are now managing these systems for profit, for stock prices, for stock options, for their CEOs. I mean, let's do it across the board and not pretend that there's some bogeyman over here or that we can just wave a magic wand and everybody will be covered without any cost to anybody else.
Okay, let's get a couple more comments and then I want to move along and if we could keep our responses a little bit shorter. Rod Grams?
Well, that's a good question, Gary. Good thing you let off with this. But when you talk about, Mark, when you say that 82% of the people haven't, we need to expand that to other areas where people can get it through their employment. Like Mr. Gibson says, you know, this puts a lot of jobs at risk because you're putting new mandates and undue burdens on the private sector that if they could provide insurance today, they would be doing that. And I think even your opponents in the primary, Jerry Janisett said, how many $2.25 bottles of beer would I have to sell? Or Mike Cerisi said, this would ruin small businesses. So these type of mandates that you throw out is just, well, it can happen and we can make sure that it happens and that business can cover it. That is not reality. And I think when you look at always going after business, you're the one who is so much against business, calling the pharmaceutical companies drug lords. And, in fact, you didn't sell all your pharmaceutical stocks until you decided to run for the U.S. Senate. Then you decided to sell them all except for one that you happened to forget. But yet you've been benefiting and profiting from these very stocks for the last 10, 20, or 30 years, and now using that money to run a campaign running against the very same things that have helped you raise your profits in the past. So I think there are things that we need to do to look at health care, but to impose new mandates without any way to pay for them except for asking the private sector to do it, I think is a mistake.
James Gibson?
Yeah, I just want to, as long as I have a chance to ask you, Senator, what do you see any progress at all in the Medicare reimbursement rate? This has been going on for a long time, and we haven't seen any progress in terms of leveling how much would be reimbursed for patients in Florida versus here. We're a major disadvantage, and this has gone on for years. You see any progress going to be made?
Well, we made some great strides, Mr. Gibson, in just the last year where we brought the Medicare reimbursement up at least to a parity. We're at about $380 now. Florida is still at about $700 and some, but we were at about $200 just 2 years ago. So the entire Minnesota delegation has worked hard to bring this level up, and in fact, I'm supporting another bill this year offered by Senator Domenici called a Medicare Plus Choice that would bring it up over $500, and we're now beginning to narrow that gap. And it can be passed this year. If we can get Democratic support and cooperation, we're going to be able to pass this, so we will narrow the gap even more for Medicare reimbursement, which is one of the biggest concerns, I think, for many of our rural hospitals and especially in our rural communities that need that help.
Okay, time to open it up for some questions from the audience here at the Chamber Debate. If you're just tuning in, this is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio, and today we're broadcasting from the Metropolitan in Golden Valley, where the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is hosting a debate between the major candidates for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Republican Rod Grams, the first debate, we should note, of the fall campaign. Senator Grams is here, Democrat Mark Dayton, and Independence candidate James Gibson are on the stage as well. And those of you here in the audience are trusty Oprah's political reporter Michael Koo and new Morning Edition host Kathy Werzer, back on public radio after starring on commercial TV. They're standing by to get to take your questions. So just get their attention. They'll get a microphone to you. Let's get started. Michael, you got a question up there?
Sure, Gary. We heard Senator Grams mention a minute ago the issue of pharmaceutical stock, and I have Bob Stassen here of Stassen and Stern who wants to follow up on that issue with Mark Dayton.
Yes, Mr. Dayton, you gained support by taking old folks to Canada to purchase prescription drugs, and you've been critical of the drug companies for overcharging. When you divested yourself of drug stocks as your campaign began, you overlooked your Abbott Lab investment of $500,000, which appeared to be somewhat embarrassing. But how about the rest of the stocks? Could you please disclose the other drug stocks you had? What were the capital gains that you made when you sold them? You raised the issue about these ill-gotten gains. Shouldn't you disclose your profit from owning these stocks?
Okay, Mark Dayton.
Mr. Stassen, the other pharmaceutical stock I owned was Novartis, and I would have to get the figures on the amount of capital gains, which I'll be glad to provide you for both that and the sale of Abbott. You know, I admitted that I overlooked it, and I have said that when I'm a private citizen, I make my investment decisions as an investor, and when I become a candidate for public office or a public official, then I apply that higher standard to my investments. I would say that whatever could be said about me from those who agree and disagree about what positions I take, I don't think that anybody could fairly accuse me of profiting through my public career or trying to profit at the public expense. I'm a wealthy man. I was lucky enough to be born into wealth, and I acknowledge that. But I think that, you know, enough has been made of this particular oversight on my part, which was a misreading of the company and its purposes, which was my mistake, for which I take full responsibility. And, you know, I think we can go back to what's really important to Minnesota, which is the fact that, as you said, sir, the pharmaceutical companies in this country are charging our senior citizens half or twice or even three times more than the same medicine made by the same manufacturer is charged in Canada. And I'm not suggesting that the solution to our problem is to have bus every Minnesotan to Canada, but rather to have our federal government do what businesses that self-insure, that HMOs do, which is to negotiate price reductions with the pharmaceutical industry. Those who say government ought to operate more like a business, certainly I would think should applaud government taking an active role to reduce the cost of what it pays for these medicines, rather than allow the companies to make the profits here in the marketplace that they are not allowed to make elsewhere around the world, and which come out of the pockets of our senior citizens and, in fact, all Americans who, one in four, who have no prescription medicine coverage.
James Gibson.
Yeah, I just want to say at the outset that I have never owned $500,000 of pharmaceutical stock. I do think too much is made of that, Mark. I have to agree with that. But the issue of drug prices in this country as relates to other countries is a serious issue. And I don't particularly put the blame on the drug companies. What we have is a situation where foreign countries place caps on what the drug companies can charge. And the natural response for the drug companies is to compensate by raising prices here. In effect, when we enact a policy of reimportation, we've given a tool to the drug companies to allow them to negotiate with the foreign countries, because suddenly, if they agree to a price with Canada, that price now takes place, is held in the United States as well. And it gives the drug companies a means to say, no, we can't agree to that price because we would have to charge the same price in the United States.
Senator Grahams, you want to comment?
Briefly, but, you know, I don't have any problems with the wealth that Mark Dayton has. What I do have problems with is the hypocritical approach that he takes, saying that it's okay for me to profit from these stocks when I'm not a candidate, but, boy, when I want to be a candidate for public office, I better divest myself of these drug lord-type stocks. And I think that's trying to be politically correct. And then to throw out all the scare tactics to our seniors to try and make political points is something else. And so I think it's the hypocritical approach to this that I have my most objections with, where Mr. Dayton says, well, we could have the government negotiate. Again, let's put the government in between you and the patient. Let's not let the doctors decide or anybody else. Let's let the government go out there and negotiate what drugs you can buy, just like Canada does. You can't get every prescription in Canada that's available in the United States. Do you want some bureaucrat in Washington making the decision on what you can and what you can't buy? Now, I'm under some prescriptions that I have to take every day as well. I don't want the government controlling that, or maybe it wouldn't be on the list that I would need, and then where would I go to get them? So I think we need to do that. And like Jim said, we do have problems with other countries because, for one, they don't respect their patents in many cases, and in others, if there are caps put on it, and if we put caps on our pharmaceutical companies and what we're seeing to not only this generation of seniors and people who use and rely and need those prescriptions to stay alive, but we're saying for others that there'll be no more new drugs created because you're basically going to put a cap on what people can and can't make. And if you do that, there's not going to be any long-term investment. There's not going to be the research and development to find that new drug next year that's going to be the cure for cancer or diabetes or any other ailment that is facing so many of us. So I think we've got to be real careful about, again, trying to have government-run, government-control health care. And this would take prescription drugs and put it right into the Hillary Care package, and I think that's what Mark is trying to do.
Quick comment, Mr. Dayton, and I want to go back.
Rod, you first opposed a solution in the private sector. Now you oppose a solution in the public sector, so you're basically opposed to any solution to any of the problems that are facing real Minnesotans. If you think that I'm the one who's scaring seniors, first of all, you just make a comment that we're going to lose all of the innovation in our industry if we negotiate, not restrict the choices of medicines, but negotiate the prices down, which is the same thing any business that self-insures or HMO does to reduce its prices for medicines by 25% to 50%. You want to just let these prices float up and have people try to buy insurance that taxpayers are going to have to subsidize to beat the ever-escalating costs. And I'm not the one who's scaring seniors. The seniors are scared because you have done nothing and Congress has done nothing. The federal government has done nothing to prevent these price escalations that are driving our seniors out of their homes, out of their standard of living, are scaring them, and are gouging their pocketbooks for profiteering.
Okay.
I just got to mention one thing
very briefly,
that I have supported very strongly government plans and reforms. I have a meds plan out myself that I introduced more than a year ago that would target those who need the help the most. And that means if there are seniors out there that have to make that tough decision between medicines and food, that we would provide them help and care. But not a plan like yours that would buy prescription drugs for yourself or Bill Gates and every other millionaire out there. And that would all come at the expense of what? Taxpayers. So I'm saying that we're going to get in there and we're going to help those seniors that need that help. But we're not going to turn this into a national-run health care system in the United States.
Kathy, you have a question down there?
Actually, Gary, we have a completely different subject to talk about right now. I'm with Nate Garvis in the audience from Target. And, Nate, you have a question about the budget.
Good morning, gentlemen. We've had a terrific ride as an economy over the last 10 years where tax revenues have exceeded government spending, something commonly known as a surplus. If you could do one thing, and I realize it's unfair because I'm asking you to limit to one thing, would you give it back to the taxpayers in the form of tax cuts or the such? Would you spend it? And if you're going to spend it on what thing, what would be your top priority? Or would you keep it and drive down the budget deficit?
Okay, we should be able to answer this one relatively quickly since the gentleman was good enough to give us a narrow question. Let's start with you, James Gibson. One thing that you would do with all that extra money?
Absolutely. I agree with Alan Greenspan on this one. He said that we should take the entire budget surplus and use it to repay the national debt. I think we have far more to gain from that than by returning it in the form of a tax cut or by expanded federal spending.
Rod Grahams, one thing that you would do with the money?
Okay, let me just say real quickly, we've got $4 here in surpluses, or $4 trillion expected. two of these dollars are going to go to Social Security to make sure we're going to pay down and keep Social Security. My lockbox, again, which I'm glad Mark Dayton agrees with, the lockbox is going to make sure that big spenders in Washington can't touch your Social Security money. Then the other $1 trillion, or these dollars, are going to be put aside is for the growth in government over the next 10 years. So that's a tremendous growth over and above the baseline. This is to take care of a lot of the things. And we have this $1 trillion surplus left. And I say we give it back to the taxpayer in the form of paying down the debt and in tax relief. The big argument over this last dollar is the Democrats, and I think Mr. Dayton supports it as well, wants to spend it and spend it on new and bigger government. So I think there's a time when the taxpayer, and by the way, this is surplus. This isn't even tax cuts. This is money that has been overcharged, and we need to make sure that we give it back. If you find a wallet on the sidewalk, what do you tell your kids to do with it? If there's $1,000 in it, you tell your kids, you find the owner of that and take it back. Well, the government has found a wallet with $4+ trillion in it. I think we need to give it back.
So tax cuts, is that?
And debt reduction.
Okay. Mark Dayton, the one top priority you would give to dealing with the surplus?
First, Murad, let me say, when you have good ideas, and you had some, I will agree with them. I hope we can find some things that we do agree on. I don't believe that there's any monopoly of wisdom on one political party. I think we're better served by having two or three or more. So I hope we can find those areas. But I would say in response to the question, it's an impossible question to answer because you're talking about something as complicated as the entire federal budget. I'll say that I agree with Senator Graham's basic division of the surplus, but the $1.8 trillion non-dedicated, I devote 67% to to deficit reduction. I devote 21% to tax cuts and 12% to increased spending for education, health care in particular.
Okay.
If I have more time, I'll go to elaborate.
James Gibson?
Yeah, I really have to take exception, Senator, with the way you characterize the surplus. You call it an overcharge. Well, we had back in 1980 about $1 trillion of national debt. We now have almost $6 trillion. Do you call the deficits that we've run up undercharges during this period of time? If we use the surplus to repay the national debt, doesn't that mean we're just simply compensating for what we've already done in the past? Aren't we simply taking care of our past irresponsibility?
And I agree with you, and Alan Greenspan does too, but Alan Greenspan doesn't say to put it all against the debt. He said that's the best way, but he said we also need tax relief in order to spur the economy and keep it growing. So we need a balance there. And I agree that these overcharges, and we should pay the debt because we should not pass on our debt to our children. So I do agree.
Senator, I was watching C-SPAN the time you questioned Alan Greenspan about what to do with the surplus. And what he said was, the best thing we can do with the surplus is to use it to repay the national debt. He said only if the surplus was going to be used for expanded federal spending would he prefer a tax cut. He does not agree with your position in the least.
He does, too. I'm sorry, Mr. Gibson, but he does. And then he also went on to say the last thing he would do is spend it. He said the worst thing we could do is grow and increase the size of the government, which, by the way, this year is growing at 9.5%. But Mr. Greenspan does agree, because I've asked him repeatedly in more than one hearing, and he does support paying down the national debt. He thinks that's important. But he said if all the money doesn't go to the debt because there's another trillion laying on the table, his fear is that it will be spent. And he thinks it should go back in the form of tax relief, if not the debt reduction.
He feels if it would be spent, he's better off with a tax cut. I agree. But what he is saying is that he wants the entire surplus used to repay the national debt.
Now he leaves some room there for tax relief.
Michael Kuh, you have a question?
I didn't see him on CNN, so I can't comment.
Michael Kuh, a question in the back of the audience.
Absolutely, Gary. I have with me John Richter here from Richter Properties, who has a question about airplane noise.
Well, I want to welcome you all to I live in Golden Valley. My business is here. I welcome all you here. Sitting at this table is a couple who moved from Minneapolis strictly because of the aircraft noise. Yesterday at church, I was meeting one of our vestry people on another issue. She mentioned the same thing. My question to you is, how long are we going to have a small in-town airport that will be maxed out in about 5 years?
Rod Grams, your turn to start.
Okay. All I can say is that the commission that was formed on the dual track ended up deciding that it would remain one airport, and that's where it's located today. But I know the concerns are, and we've worked very closely in my office with the mayor of Richfield and other surrounding communities to try to do the best we can providing funds for the citizens when it comes to insulating their homes from the noise and other things, and also trying to buy up some of the property and buffer it with some commercial property between the airport and from those homes. But right now, that's about the best plan that we've had. And I don't know, with air traffic continuing to increase and the demand for air travel, there's going to be 700 million passengers this year. And I know the people that live near or around these airports have a big problem with that, and we're trying to do the best we can to mitigate that.
Mark Dayton, James Gibson, care to comment on that one? Or Mark Dayton?
As Senator Graham said correctly, under Governor Carlson, the decision was made by himself and the Minnesota legislature that this present airport would be the site, which I think effectively, realistically, means that will be the airport site for at least the next 30 and very likely the next 50 years, barring something really extraordinary. So we need to make the best of that decision that was made. In working with Northwest and the other carriers, I think that in addition to what Senator Graham said about insulation and the like, the crux of the growing part of the problem has been the airport usage between midnight and 6 a.m., primarily for cargo purposes. And that's the piece, I think, in fairness to the people who are going to be living surrounding that airport for years to come, we really need to work with the airlines and the Metropolitan Airport Commission to address, because there's got to be some relief somewhere for people to get at least a decent night's sleep.
James Gibson?
There's no question we have a serious problem, and this isn't just in Minneapolis. It's all around the country, around airports. I think what we need are federal noise standards that apply to airports that will force airlines to upgrade their fleets perhaps faster than they otherwise would. But I think we have more of a problem. I think what we're doing, the expansion of airports and the use of airspace is not sustainable. I think ultimately we're going to have to recreate the passenger rail industry in this country. We may have to do it for other reasons. We at some point we're going to have to get serious about the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that we're emitting, and rail traffic is considerably more efficient in terms of the amount of greenhouse gas emissions per mile that we moved a passenger. So I see us rebuilding some of the passenger rail industry, particularly these short runs, for example, Minneapolis to Chicago. I think we need to make those investments.
Kathy, another question?
Yes, indeed. Ed Murphy joins us right now, Gary from St. Stephen's Church in Minneapolis, with a question about affordable housing.
Hi, there's clearly an unprecedented crisis of affordable rental housing in the Twin Cities and throughout Minnesota, greater Minnesota. Among its effects is the impact on businesses and their ability to expand and to grow and to attract and retain workers. Apparently the market is unable to provide the necessary housing, and I'm wondering what the candidates think of the role of the government, the federal government in particular, in providing more housing.
Mark Dayton, you're first on this one.
Well, Ed, I'd first say that I ended my primary campaign at St. Stephen's last Monday night, and former President Bush talked about 1,000 points of light, and I would say that one of the lights that burns the brightest in this state, in this community, is the work that you've done there to provide shelter for the homeless and feeding and the like. General Mills was the corporate sponsor the night I was there, and I think that is another example of how the responsible corporate community that we're blessed with here is involved in working with the nonprofit sector. Regarding the affordable housing, which is an acute crisis here and elsewhere around the country, both rental and ownership, I would say that those who advocate vouchers as a solution to other social problems should look at this as a case study. Back in the 1980s, the Reagan administration basically eliminated most of the federal financing for public housing, and the replacement was going to be a voucher that would be given to qualified individuals and families, and the notion was then the private sector would fill that void. In fact, it has not occurred, and understandably, the private development sector has gone to the areas of the market where it's most profitable, which is commercial and upper income housing. And so the low income, we have people all over this state and nation with so-called vouchers or other certificates and no supply in sight and no prospect. So again, I would say the federal government is a poor administrator, a manager of public housing, but it's an essential financial partner. And if it doesn't play that role, having sat on the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency board, I know that state and local governments and private nonprofits are not going to have the resources to make up the difference.
Rod Grams, James Gibson, go ahead.
to me, this is just one of many problems that are related to what jobs pay. You know, if you can't make enough money, obviously you have an affordable housing problem. You can't afford market rates for units. Long term, the solution, frankly, is the kind of economy we're experiencing now and a reasonably tight labor market that will help to drive up wages on the low end. That will help. Having said that, that's not going to solve our immediate problem. We have an immediate problem we have to deal with. I support initiatives such as the Housing Preservation Act, where we're intervening at a state level to make sure units that were based upon federally subsidized mortgages don't revert to market rates. I support initiatives that where we change local zoning standards, certain zoning standards that might inhibit the creation of affordable housing. Been recently made aware of possible problems in the unlawful detainer laws that possibly are being, they need to be examined. I'm not saying we have a problem, but I've been, people have brought that to my attention that they're possibly being administered unfairly during this time of a tight rental market.
Rod Grams, care to comment?
Well, the housing problem is not only in Minneapolis or the Twin Cities, but it's every small town across the state of Minnesota and in the country as well. And in the 8 years that I've been in Congress and had the opportunity to represent Minnesota and all the towns that I've stopped in crisscrossing the state and town meetings that I've held and meeting especially with mayors and local officials in every one of these communities, one of the biggest concerns that they bring up to me is the housing problem because of, like was mentioned, some of the low wages out there and trying to also provide housing for them and their families is important. So this is a problem that is state, not only statewide, but nationwide. We've done a number of things that we've been trying to work on, and that is to expand the mortgage insurance to allow more people to be able to afford to buy their first home. A lot of these housing units are expiring from their contracts with the government for the low income or moderate income housing, and they can revert to market rates. I'm also supporting legislation that would allow monies to be used to buy these up. We can't force these people to do this because they have lived up to their part of the bargain and the contract and agreement. It's up to us as a society to figure out how are we going to be able to provide some of these dollars that maybe we can buy these housing stocks and allow them to remain for low income. And I think we can have opportunities to do that. And also a pilot program that we're doing, and has been mentioned, the government has not been the best landlord in providing great housing. We have been blessed in Minneapolis and St. Paul with two of the greatest or best housing authorities in the country with some of the highest marks. And I've worked with them very closely over the last 6 and 8 years to try and improve the housing, especially when it comes for safety for our seniors. We passed legislation several years ago to make sure that our seniors are safe in these homes, but also trying to provide some innovative programs and grants and loans that are going to allow them to keep existing stock, maybe to expand and also to improve these facilities and locations. So there is a big task ahead, and we are working on it, but it's going to take, again, a lot of money. And when we're into budget squeezes, this is where the priorities have to be, and we're going to have to put those priorities in order.
If you're just tuning in, this is a special Meet the Candidates edition of Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten, and today we're broadcasting live from the Metropolitan, formerly Rupert's, in Golden Valley. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is sponsoring the first debate of the fall campaign between the major candidates for the U.S. Senate. Democrat Mark Dayton, Independence candidate James Gibson, and Republican incumbent Rod Grams are fielding questions from the chamber audience. And by the way, if you tuned in late, we will be rebroadcasting this program at 9 tonight. And you can also listen to this at your leisure on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. And once you log on, you'll find a wealth of other information about the candidates and the campaign. Now, if I might, can I just sneak one question in here before we get back to our audience questions? This is an easy one. Quick, we'll just go around the table here. Kind of a definition of terms, because so often language that gets used is a good indication of what people are thinking, particularly in this instance, since income levels are a basis for so much public policy that's made. What is the definition, in your mind, what is the definition of middle class and wealthy? When does how big is the middle class? What's the income range? And then when do you start being wealthy? James Gibson, you're first on this one.
Well, I'm middle class. This is upper class. No, I don't. No, very subjective thing. I don't know. If I had to get very specific about middle class income levels, I guess I would probably say a range of 30,000 to 90,000 perhaps.
Rod Grams?
Well, according to many of the programs, and especially the taxes that this administration likes to level on families, if you have a job, you're in the middle class or you're wealthy. And but when they're talking about tax cuts for the wealthy, according to Al Gore and others, that starts at about $45,000 and moves up to about $75,000 or $90,000 because we're talking about eliminating the marriage penalty. Oh, we can't do that because that's for the wealthy, but the biggest group that would benefit from that are from $45,000 to $75,000. We want to get rid of the estate tax to make sure that people who have small businesses or farms can pass it on to their family and not allow the government to step in along with the mortician and take half of everything that your families have. And I think we need to do that, but that also is considered wealthy. So to me, middle class is, you know, somewhere between $35,000 and $75,000. But, of course, like I said, there's others in Washington who believe that that's the wealthy when they want to level taxes.
Mark Dayton.
Well, upper class is where I was when I started this campaign, and lower class is where I'm likely to end up when it's over.
Does that mean you won't be running again?
In between. That's the good news of the day. In between, I would say, and it's hard to draw a dividing line, but I would say between $25,000 and $90,000 a year in income would be the range of middle income, and I think it's also a reflection of people who, as Senator Graham said, primarily work or whose income comes primarily from their work as opposed to those whose income increasingly comes from investments and other financial transactions.
Michael, your question up there?
Sure, Gary. We have Dan Larson here from the River Resource Alliance who has a question for the candidates about river traffic on the Mississippi.
Well, this is an easy question, too. So I wanted to point out that the locks on the upper Mississippi River system are old, built 60 years ago to last 50 years. Every 15 barge tow that you see moving down the river is the equivalent of 870 large semi-trailer trucks in terms of net cargo. The next Congress will have have the opportunity to authorize funding to extend several locks on the upper Mississippi River system so that farmers in Minnesota and the upper Midwest can continue to participate and lead in world grain markets. My question to you is, when that time arrives, will you vote to support authorization or oppose it?
Okay, Rod Grams, you're first.
Well, I'll say first off that I will vote to support that, and I think it's very important. Especially, as you mentioned, for our economy here in Minnesota, because so much of what we rely on for goods and services is shipped up the river for supplies and down the river when it comes to commodities that are produced here. And it does make a big difference on whether we can be competitive in Minnesota with worldwide type markets. Now, when I say that, I think we need to upgrade the locks. The Corps of Engineers are doing the study now. I have strongly supported and able to do that so we can be more efficient and be able to move more products and at lower costs. But at the same time, I think we can do this in a very environmental way. We can be conservation efforts will be implemented, but we can have the economic benefits. So there's a good balance there that we can have those recreational and environmental opportunities, the conservation opportunities that we want, but we can't shut out the economic parts of it, and that means that we need to go ahead with the improvement and expansion of these locks and dams.
Mark Dayton,
if Senator Graham says he'll spend the money for them, I think I can safely say that I would, too.
James Gibson?
You know, I don't know enough about this issue to really make an intelligent statement. I used to live on the river, so I'm intrigued by barges going up and down. That's about the only thing I can say about barges right now.
Kathy?
But I would just add, too, that, I mean, if we didn't have the barges, and as the gentleman mentioned, 870 semis, so when you look at the environmental consequences if we don't, do this, I think would be even catastrophic. So,
Kevin?
Joe Weiss from Weiss Builders in Minneapolis is in the audience today. You have a question about estate taxes?
Yes. As I'm sure you all know, Congress passed a bill with the support of a lot of Democrats to eliminate the so-called death tax. I think Senator Grams has already pointed out the merits of having done that. My question is, and hopefully it'll be a yes or no answer, is had you two gentlemen been in Congress, how would you have voted on this bill?
Mark Dayton?
I would have voted against it, but I think it deserves more explanation than that, particularly since Senator Graham's references before. You know, as you said, Gary, words can be used to clarify. Words can also be used to confuse or even mislead. And you know, this is a tax which is actually the most progressive among the federal government taxes. It brings in about $30 billion a year. It's paid only by the wealthiest 2% of the estates in America. Much is made, and the disguise is used that we're going to drive farms and small businesses into extinction if we don't eliminate it, when in fact in 1997 tax bill and even previously Congress has gone a great distance to provide for exemptions for farms, for small businesses, which I fully agree should be allowed to be continued by the next generation if they so desire. The exclusion, special exclusion was made for small businesses. A 14-year timetable for paying the estate taxes owed was provided for qualifying farms and small businesses, the first $1 million at 2% of interest. So more can be done, because I would say that those exemptions should be provided. But farms, even before this tax law was passed, paid only $500 million, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is about 1.6% of the estate tax revenues paid annually. And after the tax law changes have been instituted by 2006, it'll be barely 1% of all the estate taxes paid. Similarly, small businesses, closely held corporations, pay less than 10%, and after the estate tax reforms will pay about half of that. So the vast preponderance, 94% of the estate taxes are paid by the wealthiest people in America or their estates with liquid assets. Half of it is paid by estates that are greater than $5 million in value. And I don't see why, given the revenue needs of this country and the need for greater tax equity, that money should be shielded. And I don't see why there is a public interest in protecting ne'er-do-well rich kids like myself from getting a windfall beyond what is already provided under the tax laws. Businesses and farms, small businesses and farms, yes. Estates and assets, I think the present law should be continued.
James Gibson, how would you have voted on that bill?
Ideologically, I think I have a problem with this because we've crossed the line between taxation and confiscation. And we have a capitalistic system, a democracy, and when you cross that line, I think you undermine the very reasons why people work and struggle. And so ideologically, I think this needs to be, at the very least, the top tax rate needs to be reduced and the threshold increased. However, I've taken the position that I don't want to see tax cuts so the national debt gets paid down. I would be open to a change in the estate tax if we had some other offsetting cut or revenue source.
Senator Graham's care comment before we move on to the next
question. Oh, I got to do more than a comment, because I'll try to keep it short, though, Gary. This is one of the most unfair and unmoral taxes that we have. It was instituted in 1916 only as a temporary tax to pay off the debt for World War I. Like Ronald Reagan said, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. This is the most expensive tax for the government to collect. It takes about 65 cents for every dollar collected in expenses to collect it. So this is a very, very expensive tax to collect. It also kills jobs, many jobs for people out there that are going to lose them because those businesses or farms go out of business. So it's a job killer. It's also about $28 billion. We have numbers that say that if we could get rid of the estate tax, there are economists that believe it could actually increase the revenue to the federal government. This is a tax that is class warfare, class envy. When we talk about who gets hurt the most, it's not the very wealthy and rich. I'd like to know how much Mark Dayton is spending this year to protect his wealth. He can do it through buying insurance, having very sharp legal minds and accountants to protect as much of his wealth as he can. If you're a small business and a small farmer, can you afford a $15,000 a year policy to protect your wealth that you want to pass on to your kids? No, you can't. So when we talk about the 2%, these are the ones that are most vulnerable, and that amounts to about 500,000 Americans. So is it fair to say that we're going to have a tax that it's unfair and it hurts Americans because there's only 500,000 of them? What difference does that make? If there's one that's being treated unfairly, we shouldn't be doing this. 77% of small businesses fail after the first generation because a state tax, the death tax, drives them out of business. And when I've traveled across the state of Minnesota, I've held 1,000 meetings with farmers. This is our farmers' number one tax issue. They say, get rid of the estate tax, because they're having to spend monies that they don't want to try to protect a little bit from, so they can pass it on, because we know what happens. Sure, the government is very nice. They give you an extension of time to pay it and only charge you a small amount of interest to take away half of your lifetime savings. I think it's an immoral tax. 62% of Americans, by the way, think it's unfair. Even if they would never use it themselves, they think it's an immoral tax, and we need to get rid of it.
We only you have a quick
right,
very short
again, the farmers don't understand it because you go around and you mislead them to think it's going to apply to all of them.
Sorry, not, the farmers not, are not, too dumb
not,
to understand.
Not in this list, you know. It's not true at all. That's not what I said. It's because they're misled about it, and because they're led to believe that with a $1 million exemption by the year 2006, 675,000 now, double for spouses, charitable giving, your number 65% to collect is something I'd like to see you support, because the Brookings Institution says it's 7%. So, you know, I think that's quite a divergence. We ought to check out the facts here. But you yourself know that the exclusions that have been put into it, the extensions, the like, if you want to debate it on its merits or demerits, do so, but at least do so factually.
I'll do it factually, because I've talked with so many farmers out there that with their land and the capital intensive that farming is, it's easy to have a $2 million farm operation. Now, if we can, shield 675 or up to 1.2 million, that still exposes our farmers, even at the top end, to $800,000 at 55% is over $400,000 in cash that the IRS is going to want within 18 months. Now, I don't know many farmers that have a cash flow or small businesses in the same situation that they can afford $400,000, $500,000 to the government, because the government needs this money more than they do.
But they're not required.
Farmers are not stupid about this, neither a small business. They know what it costs them, and that's why they are very concerned about it. Not because of what I'm saying. They can read the tax laws, and they oppose them.
James Gibson?
Well, I have to agree to an extent with what Senator Grahams is talking about here. The small business quite often doesn't have the cash. That is, if somebody dies, you end up having to value the business. You might have a business that produces $100,000 in income a year, but that might be valued at $2, $3 million. And that business doesn't have the access to credit lines. It simply doesn't have the resources to pay those taxes, so it has to sell the business.
Well, again, the small businesses and farms that can have up to 14 years to pay at a reduced rate of interest after the overall exemption, after the additional exclusion. I would support increasing that so that any farm or any small business closely held could be continued without capital gains tax at all. But let's not use those two subsets, which are about 7% of all of the taxes paid, to shield all the rest. And it's,
okay.
That's the fundamental difference we have.
We're out of time here, but one quick question, and you really only have like 10 seconds to comment. Internet taxes, is it time to tax the Internet? James Gibson, yes or no?
Yes.
Rod Grahams?
If it's going to be fairer in the future, yes. I wouldn't support taxation of access to the Internet, but sales
Mark,
are a different question.
Mark Dayton?
Not access, sales. Otherwise, it disadvantages sales made by the industry.
Sales
sort of.
All right. We need to give each of you a chance to make a closing statement. 2 minutes, if you would, please. And we've got a timer here set up so we can watch Sarah over here. Alphabetical order, might as well do it that way. Mark Dayton, 2 minutes, please.
I'd like to thank the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce for hosting this debate and MPR for broadcasting it. I think this is the kind of substantive and formative discussion on the issues that really matter to Minnesotans, which I hope will distinguish this campaign. Most observers decry the preponderance of 30-second commercials, and I admit that I have bought my share of them this year. But the best counterweights to paid media are candidate debates like this one, which permit in-depth comparison of issues, of our positions on differing issues, of policies, proposals, and which require us to defend ourselves and our positions from the kind of questions we receive today. Senator Grahams, I know that the Senate calendar constrains your ability to be back in Minnesota, but fortunately the calendar is such that the Congress is scheduled to adjourn by October 6, which is a full month before the general election. So I invite you and Mr. Gibson to hold with me at least one public debate in every congressional district during that final month of the campaign, and I recommend that some of them be focused on particular issues such as Social Security or its privatization, healthcare and medicine, agriculture, education, tax reform, environmental protection, and the like. We already have enough invitations from organizations like the Chamber around the state to sponsor or host these forums, and I think that if we agree on eight of them or even more, that we'll give Minnesotans the kind of intelligent, informative, and honorable campaign that they deserve.
Okay, that was Democrat Mark Dayton. And next up, Independence candidate James Gibson.
I also want to thank the Chamber for hosting this event. We all benefit from this kind of exchange, including the candidates. I've been with Mark at a number of candidate forums that have occurred in the prior year, and we always walk away with a little bit more knowledge. I'm going to touch upon the theme of my campaign here in my time. My campaign is about what I call intergenerational justice. That simply means doing right by the next generation. I can frame just about any issue in that framework. So, number one, I want to see the entire surplus used to repay the national debt. To me, this is a debt we ought not to be passing along to our kids. To the extent that we need additional government services, I want to find offsetting cuts or other sources of revenue. But what I don't want to see is 1,000 different reasons why we never take care of this debt. That's very easy for it to happen. Secondly, I want to move Social Security from a pay-as-you-go system to one that has real assets, so we're not simply passing along IOUs to the next generation. Third, educationally, we need to prepare our kids for an increasingly integrated and interdependent global economy. It's not enough that they can compete well with kids from other states. They need to compete well with kids from other nations. And environmentally, we need to leave the world a better place than we found it. It doesn't mean we have to solve all of our problems overnight, but we need to make steady progress. These are all intergenerational justice issues. One other issue I've mapped out is campaign finance reform. If we want to see legislation that reflects the broad public interest, we need to change the way campaigns are financed. In all due fairness, Mark, you may be the strongest candidate in the DFL primary, but we'll never know because of the amount of money that you've spent. We need to change the way campaigns are financed. Jerry Janicich and Rebecca Yonish were at a tremendous disadvantage in that race. Intergenerational justice, the theme of my campaign, I'm going to advocate for it strongly, and it comes from my heart that we need to simply take care of the next generation and take what we've inherited, be a good steward, and leave a better world for the next generation.
That was Independence candidate James Gibson, and finally, Republican Rod Grams.
Thank you very much, Gary, and I want to thank the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and also Minnesota Public Radio for hosting this event today. But before I leave, too, I want to talk a little bit about some of the important issues, or the one important issue that I've been working on now for more than 7 years, and that is Social Security. I know Mr. Dayton has spent $10, $12, $15 million in ads combined with his other opponents saying that I want to tear down Social Security. These are scare tactics. These are juvenile phrases such as risky schemes. These aren't risky schemes. The biggest risk is doing nothing at all. Even Bill Clinton, President Clinton, said there's three things that we could do with Social Security. We either have to raise taxes, cut benefits, or find a higher rate of return in investments in order to save and secure Social Security. Well, Mr. Dayton doesn't support investments. So the question I would ask him is, what does he want to do? Raise your taxes, or is he going to cut benefits to our seniors? Now, Al Gore takes the same approach. We're going to do nothing. We're going to draw the line. We're going to keep the old Social Security system. We can do better. We need to reform Medicare, created in 1965. It doesn't provide for prescription drugs. Today, if we were going to create the program, it would include that. Social Security, designed in 1935, when there was 100 workers for every retiree. Today, there's only 2.5 workers for every retiree, and in 20 years, there'll be less than 2. What kind of a burden are we going to pass to our children and grandchildren? We can do better. And my plan, by the way, doesn't tear down Social Security. In fact, I have 6 principles when I developed this plan. First, protect everybody that's on Social Security. Make them better off, not worse. But give people the option, number 2, to have either private retirement accounts or stay with Social Security. Provide improved retirement security for workers better than now that is available. And replace today's pay-as-you-go system. There is no funds, no assets in Washington. For all of the money you've spent in the Social Security, there's no account in Washington with your name on it with $1. We can do better, and I object to the responses that I'm tearing down Social Security. I am the only candidate that has worked for 7 years to improve and make sure Social Security is safe for the future.
Republican Rod Grams. Well, that concludes today's Minnesota Chamber of Commerce debate between the candidates for the U.S. Senate, the first debate of the general election campaign. Our thanks to all 3 candidates, James Gibson, Rod Grams, and Mark Dayton, for participating.
Our thanks to the Chamber for sponsoring this debate and for allowing us to moderate the debate and broadcast it. Now, for those of you here at the Metropolitan, I understand it's time for lunch. Those of you listening on the radio, we're going to break for news headlines, and then we'll be back for more from the Metropolitan. University of Minnesota political scientist and congressional expert Stephen Smith will be joining us to discuss the campaign. We'll also be opening the phone lines for questions.